City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. We shall have Glenn Kimball. Was biblical prophet Melchizedek also Merlin the magician of the fabled King Arthur days during the 6th century? How can that be? And then a few glimpses of the visions of George Washington. We'll also talk about the undead. Glenn Kimball has a BA in journalism and MA in communications. In addition, he has successfully completed all coursework for a PhD in communications and passed his doctoral exams, lacking yet his dissertation. He's got to get that done. He was the former president of International Exchange School, vice president of two cellular phone companies. Glenn has taught school at Southern Illinois University and was ranked by student evaluations in the top 10 instructors at that university. He has been collecting ancient texts since the age of 15 and is famous for being able to integrate very diverse texts in a contiguous storyline. Welcome to Coast, Glenn Kimball. Hey, Glenn, how are you?
Oh, it's so good to talk to you again. You're one of my favorite characters, well-read, knowledgeable, someone we can have fun with.
And a character, no doubt, believe me.
We're going to talk about some characters tonight.
Absolutely. Was, by the way, Southern Illinois University, was that Carbondale where you went?
Absolutely. Yeah. The Salukis.
Not too far from St. Louis.
No, that's real close to Cahokia, where the great Monk's Mound is.
That's right.
That pyramid's located.
Were you there during the days where the college kids went crazy during Halloween?
Yes, I was.
Wow, that's another story all by itself, isn't
we
it?
We could have some fun with that one.
You have uncovered some incredible stories here, and I want everybody to get to the coasttocoastam.com website, where you're linked up with your website, which is ancientmanuscripts.com. And also there's a couple new links right under your name, a couple CD links, which we'll talk about as well. Because that's a basis for a lot of the work that you have now done, isn't it?
That's correct. There are the CDs which give the rest of the story that is so broad we couldn't possibly cover it all on the air. We're going to cover the banner headlines.
You know what? We might not even have enough time tonight, Glenn, but we'll do the best we can. There's so much to talk about. I am fascinated, by the way, of biblical prophecy. I always have been. And to this, you know, to just to see, my, is this stuff going to come true? Has it come true? But there was a person a long time ago that I want you to tell us about, because some of us may not even know who he was, but a prophet called Melchizedek. What about him?
Well, Melchizedek was the second most important prophet in the Old Testament. Well, actually, in the entire Bible, he's second only to Jesus in the sense that even Jesus himself, if you go to Hebrews 5 and 10, Jesus is linked intimately with Melchizedek, because in verse 7, God calls Jesus to be a priest after the order of Melchizedek. There's not even one single additional character to whom Jesus is associated with in all of the biblical scripture. So Melchizedek emerges as an extremely significant character and plays an integral role in many different parts of the Bible and indeed throughout history.
How old was this guy?
Well, in order to understand who Melchizedek was, Melchizedek is both a title and an individual. The Zedek part of it, the last part of his name, means of righteousness. The Melchizedek means king of righteousness, as opposed to Adonizedek, who was also a biblical character, which meant lord of righteousness. The Zedek portion became, they took the pagans of Canaan, the Canaanites in Sodom and Gomorrah era, made their entire deities named after the Zedeks because of Melchizedek. They were the Zedeks, or the deity of righteousness. which is amazing to me. But Melchizedek, to identify him in history, the Midrash, or the Jewish Midrash, which is the history of the Old Testament for the Jews, says that Melchizedek was, in fact, called under another name. That other name was Shem, or the son of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So by the time Melchizedek appears in the Old Testament, Melchizedek is either 530 years old or 800-and-something years old, if we believe David Dahl's version of the Old Testament, which I think he is absolutely correct. A very, very old man, either that or a man who did not die. we're going to talk about that. But Melchizedek, if in fact he was alive during the time of Abraham, had been alive for a very, very long time, because the person who ordained him to the office of high priest, the second most important prophet in the Old Testament, had been the prophet Enoch. This Enoch character was before the flood, remember? Enoch was the man who had the encounters with the watchers. Do you remember who the watchers were? They were the Nephilim. These were the people who were not of the bloodline of Adam and Eve.
And some say came down from above, right?
And they most certainly did. They were not a part of this scenario. And this is a key point, because later on we're going to take this term watcher and apply it into the King Arthur history of time, because the Druids, their greatest god in their legends, terms himself a watcher. And they could not have gotten that term from any other source save it be from Melchizedek himself.
Well, then it's possible, if he didn't die, and if he lived that long, could he be around now?
Well, most certainly that is possible, because we turn to Hebrews again, the verse 7, and may I just quote it for you. Paul said that Melchizedek had offered up his prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death. Which means that Melchizedek didn't die. As a matter of fact, one of the most important characteristics associated with the prophet Melchizedek was that he was reported to have not had a mother or a father or children.
Now, that's strange.
Now, understand that he obviously had a mother and father, and he obviously had children in his own day. But he appears at this moment in history when Abraham goes to Melchizedek, who was the king of Salem, the predecessor of Jerusalem. He was the king of the territory, honored by the Egyptians as king and rightful king of Salem. This man, when he imposes himself at this moment in history, no one can remember his mother and father. No one can remember him having children. He appears, and then he vanishes in history, because by the time Abraham looks for a wife for his son Isaac, he can't find Melchizedek, and has to go to Mesopotamia to find a wife for his son Isaac.
What's the significance of not being able to find him?
Because he's not there.
Where'd he go?
He survives death and goes and performs what I call, and pardon me, you're going to have to let me use my own terms, because I've coined a few terms to help with the explanation.
Okay.
He becomes one of the undead that appears and disappears and performs rescues.
One of the undead?
One of the undead, meaning that he had lived a life, but that he did not die.
Now, what would have happened had somebody tossed a spear at him or whacked him with a sword or something? I mean, would he have just...
Let's use a better example. What if they were to reach out and shake his hand?
All right.
They would be able to feel his hand in theirs.
A physical hand.
Right. Unlike an angel, in the classical sense of the word, if you were to reach out and try and handshake an angel, you wouldn't feel anything.
No, you'd go right through it. Yeah, okay, I agree with that.
Okay? So, you know, we have lumped many of the beings from the other world, I call it the other world, that's my phraseology too, we've lumped them all in the category of angels, when in reality they are very different origins and very different characteristics. And this classification of the undead is totally significant and with a great deal of precedence.
Well, yeah, but the fact that you can reach out and touch Melchizedek's hand, to me, that also means that, again, going back to the sword theory, because my thought is that maybe he doesn't die of old age, but can he die if somebody spears the guy or something?
Certainly that is possible, and let me give you an example. One of the confusions over Christ when he appeared was they thought he was the undead Elijah. Now, Elijah was another person who clearly is classified under this heading of the undead. Now, many people have suggested that because Jesus was confused with Elijah during his day, that Jesus was the reincarnation of Elijah. The point of the issue is here is that in his day, in the day of Christ, Jesus was mistaken for Elijah, and they believed Elijah to be undead. And so you cannot be a reincarnation of a person who has never died.
No, you can't. It's impossible.
It is impossible. They actually physically thought Jesus was the undead Elijah, another member of the undead. But getting back to your sword situation here for a moment,
because I'm thinking maybe he was killed, physically killed. If he's a physical being, you know, maybe something could have happened to him along the line.
Well, certainly there's another classification.
It's like the Highlander, where you get him, you chop off his head, and that's it for them.
Well, there's another classification of beings called resurrected beings. These are people who had suffered death but were resurrected.
All right.
Now we turn to Matthew 27:52-53, and we notice that alongside Christ, many of the ancient prophets were in fact resurrected, which means that they had lived, had died, and then retrieved their body from the tomb and were resurrected.
That's not the case, though, for him, is it?
No. This is a different classification entirely. These are people who had not suffered death.
How did he get his apparent unlimited lifespan?
It says, Paul says, that he got it by strong prayers and supplications and long tears, and that he had been... Let's look at it this way.
I mean, was he like a chosen person, Glenn?
Yes, very much so. In fact, it's a blessing. Let's look at it from God's point of view for a moment. If you were to ask God for a single wish, many of the ancient prophets, if it were me, I would say, take me to heaven, you know.
Well, is that what you would wish for?
Probably. But these ancient prophets that were the undead did not ask for that. They asked God to tarry till he comes again, and to be able to intervene in the lives of men until he comes again. Now, Elijah and Elias were granted that, and they, in fact, are the two prophets who will appear in the final scenario of Armageddon and will die in the streets of Jerusalem. They are not yet dead, but they will be slain in Jerusalem.
Where are they?
They're amongst us. The Bible says there are angels that walk amongst us unseen. They continue with us on a continuous basis.
Well, would I like to uncover that?
I met one of them, and we'll talk to you about that. And my daughter's met one, my brother's met one, and I'll bet you there's 1 million of your listeners who have had a similar
encounter. All right, we're going to have to talk about that, too. Talk about that. But getting back to our friend Melchizedek, and how do you pronounce his name, anyway?
Melchizedek.
Melchizedek. Okay.
Right.
You believe he was a prophet, do you?
He was three things. He was a prophet, a priest, and a king. Now remember, king is important in this thing as well. You had to not only be a prophet and a priest, but you also had to be a king in order to be this thing called Melchizedek or the undead. That's why Jesus was often thought of as being the reincarnation of Melchizedek as well. In fact, they thought that he was Melchizedek. He was mistaken for Melchizedek, or that Melchizedek was Jesus in a former reincarnation. You know, at least that's people in our day have thought that.
Hmm.
But that's not the case. Melchizedek was a person who did not have mother and father. Jesus was a person who was born of immaculate conception or of unnatural cause.
All right, let's jump ahead then. How does how does he, with some of your thoughts, possibly end up during the era of King Arthur, which would have been, what, the 6th century?
Yes, around 530 A.D.
I mean, we're talking about thousands of years.
Absolutely.
And again, we'll try to talk about the fact that he may be here now in our lifetime. But in what basis, in what form is he during the King Arthur period?
Well, certainly King Arthur, during the King Arthur period, King Arthur was a great Christian king. No one disputes that in history.
Right.
Even those who believe that King Arthur was a myth still attribute him to being a great Christian king who lived in England at the time when the Roman Empire withdrew its forces and left the British people to the devices, their own devices, and to defend themselves against the Saxons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, remember what the word Saxon means.
What's it mean?
Israel.
Ah, okay.
All right. So these were some of the 10 tribes coming over to conquer England, but they didn't want to be conquered. I mean, no one wants to have their blood shed and be told what to do. But the Saxons certainly integrated themselves at the time of King Arthur. But the greatest mentor of King Arthur now, in fact, the singular character who was a mentor of King Arthur, was who?
My favorite, Merlin the Magician.
Merlin the Magician. Now, let's take the word magician and find its derivative for a moment. A magician is a fraternal member of the Magi.
Right.
And who were the Magi in the biblical sense, in the time of Jesus?
Well, they were the three wise men, weren't they?
Of course they were.
Boy, I'm glad I did my homework with you.
In other words, the Magi were a worldwide fraternity of mathematicians, astrologers,
alchemists.
These were called wise men because they were professorial in nature. They taught their wisdom. They sat alongside every pharaoh in Egypt from its inception. They sat alongside all of the Caesars in Rome. They sat alongside all of the emperors in China and the royal family members of India. This fraternity began at the great schools of Stonehenge, Stonehenge orientation. By the way, the origin of the word Druid, if you Latinize it, take it into the Latin, the word becomes Magi.
Okay, but what makes you think that Melchizedek was Merlin the Magician?
Well, we can go down the list of proof. Not the least of which was, we have to look at the character of Merlin the Magician. Many of the historians claim that he was the composite of five different characters. The problem with being five different characters is that they were five different characters in different periods of time. In other words, Gregory of Marmoth says that Merlin the Magician mentored king after king after king
mm-hmm.
after king. In other words, he not only mentored one king, King Arthur, but mentored subsequent kings as well.
So he was someone who lived himself a long time.
Extremely long time, well beyond the normal lifespan of a human being.
Right.
And in addition, we're probably the only generation in history who did not know the connection between Melchizedek and Merlin. Can I tell you why?
Why?
If you go to the British Museum, this is just a simple example. If you go to the British Museum, there's a great stained glass window in the British Museum, preserved by the great museum, that is called Melchizedek. This is a picture of Melchizedek ordaining King Arthur as king, with Sir Galahad in the back holding the Holy Grail.
That's a great picture.
You imagine that.
Stay with
Why
us.
Why is Melchizedek ordaining King Arthur when, in fact, the greatest mentor of King Arthur was Merlin? Perhaps they are. Could it be the same person?
Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Glenn Kimball, my guest. Glenn, let's see how we tie in a little bit more of some of these thoughts and evidence about Melchizedek and Merlin the Magician. And then we'll figure out where he might be now if you think he's still alive, okay?
Okay.
All right. So he's during King Arthur's day. There's this dramatic picture of him with King Arthur.
There's additional evidence, George.
Beyond a picture, of course.
Yes, of course. There was a whole society of Catholic monks in the 17th and 18th century who had written the history of all people of Merlin the Magician and claimed his association with Melchizedek because this Merlin had taught the words of Melchizedek. They also suggested that Merlin was one of the people who, like Melchizedek, did not have a father and a mother and had no descendants.
He just kind of appeared, huh?
He appeared and then he disappeared in history. And so are we the only generation that has made this, that hasn't made this connection?
Do you think that as he moves along in history, he changes his name or he becomes something else?
Well, he certainly didn't call himself Merlin during the days of Merlin, because Merlin is the composite of five different names.
Okay.
Midrin was one of those names. So, you know, if you were to go back into English lore and ask, where is Merlin the Magician, they wouldn't know who you were talking of.
Fascinating, though, that it all starts with M.
Yes. They speak more often of the term Melchizedek than they do of Merlin the Magician.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the Landulf Charters, which were signed by the Great Iron Bear himself, King Arthur, he mentions Melchizedek as his mentor, not Merlin the Magician.
Well, do you think the prophet would have told King Arthur, hey, this is who I am?
I am certain that he would have.
Okay.
I'm certain that he would have. And that's why King Arthur makes mention so often in the writings that are attributed to him. No one really knows whether he wrote these things other than the fact that his signature is on the Landulf Charters itself. You know, it may have been a forgery. We don't know. But at least they survive in our day, and the scholars that are dealing now with this brand-new find of the Landulf Charters claim that it's totally authentic, and Wilson and Bram from Great Britain also suggested that it's an absolutely authentic document written by the Great Iron Bear. Arthur means Iron Bear, by the way. You know, these are the words that survive in our day, and he speaks of Melchizedek.
Well, Glenn, if we had the photographs in those days, obviously we don't, would Melchizedek have looked the same during the biblical days, during the King Arthur days? I mean, would he have been the same physical-looking person?
You know, you're asking me something I've never thought. I don't know.
I bet he would have.
I bet he would have. I would presume so. I know one thing, that the Melchizedek, the vestments or the clothing of Merlin the Magician was identical with the clothing of Melchizedek. The same clothing was worn by the two of them.
You mean over all these years?
Yes.
He never changed his style, huh?
Well, he needed to change clothes, I'm sure, but the style of the clothes was the same. As a matter of fact...
Thank God they didn't have leisure suits back in those days. he really would have looked out of place.
That's why I like you so much, George. But, you know, one of the interesting things about this clothing thing, when Homer wrote his great epic poem, Jason and the Golden Fleece...
Mm-hmm.
One of the characteristics of the clothing of Melchizedek was that he wore a temple robe made out of ram skin or goat fleece.
And that's biblical, isn't it?
It is biblical. And one of the things that Homer knew, because he knew the stories of Melchizedek intimately well and had integrated them into Greek mythology, when Jason was out seeking the golden fleece, you have to say, why wasn't he seeking the golden coins or the golden bars?
Right.
You know, he was seeking this golden fleece, which he attributes this golden fleece as having power to save and protect his kingdom. This was a powerful robe of clothing. It was a temple robe with power and energy in it. There was the power of Melchizedek to preserve a kingdom.
And there is no question that Melchizedek and Merlin the Magician possessed incredible powers.
Without doubt. That's why the magicians are magi, or the magi are magicians.
Now, if I remember my mythology here, was King Arthur, when he was a little boy and he pulled the sword out of the rock, wasn't Merlin there at that time too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah. Brilliantly so. And we might interject here, in addition to what you just said, remember what Merlin told King Arthur right from the outset. He said, I am living my life backwards through history.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he has been to the future, he appears in the present, and he also appears in the past, and had mentored people all along the way.
What was his role, Glenn? The kind of people that he mentored. What was his goal here?
He was primarily the mentor of kings. That's why I emphasized in our first half hour that he was a prophet, priest, and a king,
mm-hmm.
and a mentor of kings, and Jesus himself was a fraternal member of this order of Melchizedek, this priestly order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek was the source from which all society arrived at its wisdom. We can even turn to Egypt, for example. We can place Melchizedek's teachings in Egypt. Remember that Melchizedek was a king recognized by the Egyptians as the king of Salem, the ancient Jerusalem.
And he would have also witnessed the flood, right? Way gone back.
Been there with the flood. That's exactly right. And remember that Melchizedek was a priest inside a temple. And who had built this temple? The ancestors of the Druids had built this temple in what year? On the Dome of the Rock, where Suleiman's Mosque is today. They had built a temple long before Solomon had built a temple. And it was the temple in which Melchizedek officiated, where he wore his golden fleece robe.
Right.
He built this temple in 2700 years B.C., which is exactly the same century that the pyramids in Egypt were built.
And the floods were what, 5000 B.C.?
The floods were...
Weren't they?
Depending upon if David Roll is right, you know, the Bible accounts are 300 years off. The temple was just after the flood.
Okay? Okay.
Now, the temple was built there... This temple, let me boil it down to a phrase that people can understand. The temple was a resurrection machine. Okay?
All right. I'm with you.
It was a school. It was a school of the wise men, a school of the kings, a school of the priests. That's why Moses carried one through the desert. But now the Egyptians had heard of this because Melchizedek was, in fact, a recognized king in Egypt. So they, not wanting to be second, built their own temples,
mm-hmm.
or resurrection machines, which were what?
Pyramids.
Absolutely.
God, you know, if you were my college professor, I'd be acing this course right now.
Well, you're an ace anyway, George. But, you know, remember the story that surrounds the pyramids? It's the story of Isis, Osiris, and Horus.
Right.
Which is the story of virgin birth, crucifixion, and resurrection.
Do you think that Melchizedek believed in reincarnation?
Absolutely not.
He did not?
Did
not believe in that? Okay.
No, I do not believe so.
All right.
And I have my own, and I have personal reasons, and I have historical reasons for believing that. I had a near-death experience, as I had once told you, George.
Yes.
And the one place I went to, it was the library in heaven. Pardon me, I don't mean to digress a long ways from this, but each of our lives are recorded in that library in virtual reality. They're not recorded on paper and ink. They're recorded as we see them through our eyes and feel them with our hearts and touch them with our hands. And that's why when you have a review of your life at the very end of your life, you can play the fast-forward version and see as if you were that person.
And you get it all real fast.
Yeah, and there are people who have broken into that library, either legitimately through meditation and prayer or
mm-hmm.
through other means, and they have had this experience of seeing through the eyes of someone else and feeling with their hearts and their hands, and they have mistaken it as being their own or mine. It's my experience. It belongs to me. Me. When in reality, that's a mistake. What they have really done is shared the experience in the Lamb's Book of Life of someone else that's totally unique. And that is the origin of the reincarnation phenomena. And it's, pardon me, I know I'm offending thousands of people who still believe in reincarnation and thousands who have had a memory in the first person of
being. Well, I don't think you're offending. This is your views, and you're entitled. I'm entitled, right. And the next person's entitled.
Right. In reality, we can, in fact, share each other's experiences through meditation, through prayer, through other techniques.
I believe that.
We can break into each other's lives. As a matter of fact, one of the things about Jesus, that we think that Jesus' greatest suffering was on the cross, that's not the truth. The greatest suffering, clearly in the Bible, was in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he'd sweat drops of blood. And why did he sweat drops of blood in the Garden of Gethsemane, for heaven's sake? The reason why he sweat great drops of blood in the Garden of Gethsemane was because he was experiencing the Lamb's Book of Life from beginning to end, where he saw through everybody's eyes, saw the good and evil of all of us through our own eyes, and it caused him such great pain, it caused him to sweat drops of blood. Now, we too will have an opportunity to read the Lamb's Book of Life, and we too will be able to, because it's not possible to experience all good and evil in one lifetime, and I don't care how good you are or how bad you are, there's no way for you to get the entire exposure to good and evil, which is the very purpose of coming to this world. We must be able to share each other's burdens and bear each other's sorrows, as it says in the Scriptures, and we do that by reading the Lamb's Book of Life and sharing it with each other. In that sense of the word, it's a level playing field for everybody on the earth, whether you've lived 6 minutes or 962 years like Methuselah. We all have to read the same book, and we all are exposed to the same amount of knowledge, because that book is finite.
Which leads into another Melchizedek question, and that is, there's no question in your mind, he was good all along the line, wasn't he?
He was the king of righteousness. That's what his name literally means.
All right. So no evil in this person?
None. He was so completely void of evil that he was able to survive death.
Glenn, one's got to assume, if the theories are correct, that if he was there during the biblical days, if he was there during the King Arthur days, then he's got this incredible lifespan. One has to assume he's moved on into other realms, albeit not the 6th century. Maybe he went into the 12th century. Maybe he went into the 20th century. Maybe he's here now. I would have to assume that if he was alive then, he's alive today. If he is, and first of all, do you believe that he might be?
Absolutely.
Where is he?
He's amongst us. I can only tell you my personal story, and I don't know whether the individual I met was, in fact, Melchizedek, or Elijah, or Elias, or any of the other members of the undead. John the Beloved was given that gift, the apostle of Christ.
But he's got to be somewhere.
It was one of the undead, but I had an experience when I was finishing my first book. You know, you have to understand that I am nobody. I may be well educated, and I may have collected a lot of ancient texts, but you know, I
wouldn't say you're not a nobody.
Well, I don't. I've always felt myself to be. I've always been amazed that anyone would listen to me.
Well, you're getting 10 million of them tonight.
Well, we are indeed. But I had an experience when I wrote my first book, The Hidden Stories of the Childhood of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
I had just completed the text, and I had had a near-death experience where I turned around and met the man who did not need a name tag, and he told me that he would take me if I wanted to leave the earth then, because I'd prayed for death for 3.5 years. He said, but I would miss the purpose of my life. And when he said purpose, my whole being shook, and I thought, oh, goodness, you mean there's a purpose to this maniacal madness?
You just figured it out, huh?
And I suddenly realized in an instant what that purpose was to write from the text that I had, for some strange reason, collected from the time I was 15. Why did I start at 15 to collect ancient manuscripts like a kid collects baseball cards?
There would be no reason other than somebody had a mission for you.
Yeah, it was weird, you know. But I wrote this book on Jesus, and then right when I finished the text, I suddenly became totally self-conscious, upset to the max. I was working at a restaurant. I'd closed the doors for the night, and I took my manuscript, I had it in my hand, and I said, I'm going to throw this in the garbage because I'm only going to embarrass myself and embarrass my family and raise myself to criticism all over the world. People are never going to forget what I have done here.
You were all done with it.
I was all done with it. And I raised my hand to throw it in the trash, and in came in through the door came a man. And now, remember, I'd locked the doors.
Yeah, exactly.
And I thought, well, I, for some reason, didn't get the door locked.
I didn't lock this one, right?
Yeah, I didn't get a lock for some reason. So I put the manuscript on the counter, and I turned to the man and said, may I help you? And he said, no, but I can help you. And, you know, me and my flippant attitude, I said, well, I don't need insurance. You know? Pardon me, but that's my character.
Yeah.
I would say something like that. And he's you know, he had a small smile. It wasn't a chuckle, but it was a smile. And he said, point blank, and he shook my hand, so I touched him. And he said, we do not want you, he used the word we do not want you to throw your manuscript in the garbage, because it will be the source of hope for tens of thousands of people. And I lost it. I mean, I dropped everything. Nobody had any.
I mean, could he have seen you through the window or anything like that?
I don't think so, because they were bronzed windows.
All right.
So they could not be seen from the outside, you know? And certainly he wouldn't know that I was throwing away a text.
No, that's true.
Throwing away financial documents.
Or a menu or something like
that.
Yeah,
something along those lines. But I dropped everything on the floor, and I bent over to pick it up, and I stood up. And he was gone.
As quickly as he popped in.
Yeah, as quickly as popped in. And I went to the door to run out, and the door was locked. Now, who was that guy?
Was it Melchizedek?
I don't know. Maybe. I think maybe. Could have been. It could have been. I certainly have felt compelled over the last couple of years to write on Melchizedek.
Does he appear for dramatic purposes, or might he be out there helping individuals like he did you?
I think that he does both. He is at key moments in history, like at the time of King Arthur, at the invasion of Saxons, but he also appears to rescue individuals at the most amazingly poignant times in their individual lives. There are probably millions of stories out there of people who have been in distress, mortal danger, or in trouble, and someone appears suddenly, gives them a piece of advice, fixes their flat tire,
shows up on a park bench. Because I've got to tell you that story, Glenn, which I've mentioned many, many months ago when I first started doing Coast to Coast. But
oh no,
you may be onto something with this one.
Not you too.
Well, no, I didn't see him, but it was a story that was given to me, which will send the chills up your spine.
We need to do this.
And maybe a lot of people call him their guardian angel. Is that possible?
Certainly true. We've lumped angels, guardian angels, everything into this category.
Welcome back. I'm George Norrie. Glenn Kimball, my guest. Let's continue to talk a little bit, if we can, Glenn, about Melchizedek, and then we'll move on to some angels. And they may all be one of the same. You know what?
Perhaps. I think they are separate. There's a 24-hour number, though, for those who are interested.
Okay. What is that number?
888-904-9395.
24 hours?
Yes. You're on at night, George.
Yeah, that's true, too. That's true. You got to be ready for that all the time. I mean, but you think, if prophecy is correct, and if everything that a lot of people have written about him over the years is correct, he's out here, but it's not like he has appeared in a grand scale this time. And I'm curious why, because it appears that he was with some tremendous people during his period of, I don't know if I should call it life on this planet or not, but he seems to have influenced some people, heavy hitters of the world. Why not now?
Well, that may not be true, George. He may, in fact, have been with some very major people in our day. Not the least of which might have been George Washington, for example.
Okay.
We'll get back to that later.
All right.
But certainly there are kings and people that have and presidents and rulers of countries who have talked about being mentored by a person who comes into their life, gives them advice, tells them about the future, and suddenly it disappears as quickly as he has appeared. We know that in Russia there was the great Melchizedek of the Forest, who appeared in the 1800s, who was apparently one of the administrators or advisors to the czars, you know. So we don't know that he was not necessarily a mentor of kings in our day.
And I guess a president, for example, won't come forward and tell the world, oh, by the way, I've been talking to Melchizedek.
Most certainly that would be a difficult thing for him to admit, and was for George Washington as well. You know, it was for anybody. It's difficult for me to admit, you know, that I met someone. People think I was thinking to myself, if I ever tell the story to anyone, they're going to think I'm nuts. In fact, I even went to a psychiatrist one time and told him this story and said, you know, I'm concerned that maybe I'm pre-schizophrenic of some sort. And after he took blood tests and did his psychoanalysis for a couple of sessions, he turned to me and he says, what you need, Mr. Kimball, is the clergy, not a psychiatrist. I was concerned about myself. I'm as objective as anybody else, wanting to know the truth. You know, your great guest last night suggested something I thought was wonderful, you know. The age of the earth, or the crust of the earth, is an ancient text itself, and it cannot be ignored. It tells the truth. And one of the chapters is the earth is 4.5 billion years old. And one of the other chapters is that there is a significant 6,000 years history. Those are not mutually exclusive events, though we tend to believe them to be mutually exclusive events, that one cannot be true as well as the other. In my opinion, the question should be, why can't they both be true? So your guest last night was just stunningly perfect in his analysis as far as I was concerned.
All right, so with your theory then, maybe he has consulted with people, presidents and higher-ups, those in authority, I guess, world authority. How long will he continue, Glenn? I mean, will he go way out into the future? I mean, way out? Hundreds of more years? Thousands of years?
Well, interestingly enough, you know, King Arthur said in his day, and this is based on research by Wilson and Bram in the book Holy Kingdom, written by Adrian Gilbert. You've had him on your podcast before. That on the lead-lined casket of the real King Arthur, it said, I will return with my mentor at his second coming. And if that was King Arthur, certainly he got that information from, if in fact my theory is correct, he got that from Melchizedek, who is also pointed toward this period of the quote-unquote second coming. So the answer is they will survive and mentor until the second coming. Elias and Elijah are prophesied to be to survive until they die in the streets of Jerusalem as being the two prophets who will die at the scene of Armageddon. So, you know, I suspect that is the ending point that you're asking me about.
Exactly.
That they will live until that period of time. But, you know, what a great blessing it would have been to have been allowed by God to intervene in the lives of men and perform rescue, become the Lone Ranger of history. Pardon me for being irreverent there. But to be able to do good things and to appear and disappear and to have that sweet feeling of being involved in people's lives from time to time and helping them and saving them and rescuing them. I can't think of a thing that I would rather do than doing that. It must have been the greatest present or gift a deity could give someone in this life.
It's like it's his mission. That's what he was put on this planet for.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly so.
But do you believe he's physical still or more spirit?
No, he's definitely physical. These are people that you can touch with your hands. They will appear totally like human beings.
Same body, or do you think he gets into different bodies along the line?
Well, we're told that they went through a translation or a transfiguration of some sort. It's the same body, probably different blood than we have in our veins. But certainly the same corporal presence as they had when they were alive. You know, we are born in corruption, but we're raised in incorruption, but certainly the lifespan of men is subject to deity alone. Who's to say we cannot live? You know, there are scientists that suggest that the body is capable of living interminably, depending upon disease and accident.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about angels and how maybe he could be construed as being a guardian angel. You know, when people say, hey, my guardian angel saved me, maybe they're looking at him. There was a story that I've echoed a couple times, Glenn, where someone was extremely despondent. He called me on my local show years ago. He was almost suicidal. And he said he got into his car and just kept driving and driving and driving, drove about 100 miles and got to a small little town where he saw a little lake and ducks flying. And he just got out there, sat on the park bench, and while he was there, he said a farmer came up in the coveralls and things, sat down next to him, and they just talked about life. And he said by the time he was done chatting, he felt so enlightened, he wasn't despondent anymore. He thanked the farmer, he left and came back home. And a year later, he wanted to come back out to this little town and thank the farmer because his whole life had changed. He had a better job, everything. Everything had changed positively for this guy. And he goes in and he says, well, how am I going to find this guy? So, you know, in a little tiny community, you go to the barber shop, right?
Right.
So he does that. And the barber says, well, I think you better go up to the top of the hill and in the White House, go talk to his daughter. And he knew then that something was wrong, just the way the barber was talking about it. So he goes up to the house, he knocks on the door, and a girl comes out. She's in her late 20s, early 30s. And he says, I wanted to ask you about your father, and I wanted to thank him personally. About a year ago, he helped me a lot. He saved my life, and I just wanted to thank him. And she interrupted him and said, well, you're the fifth person to come up here to thank me for what he did. And he said, oh, really? And she said, yeah, the problem is he died 15 years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
And with stories like that, you think of her father, but you also think of the possibility of someone like a Melchizedek who might be there, too.
Well, you know, we have... There's a two-part story that really pertains to Art Bell. He had open phone for him one night. Part of it was the story he had on the air, and part of it was my personal story with my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But he told the story of that there was a caller called in and said that he was moving, and that he had moved all of his things over, but the car was still attached to the truck that moved the things. Apparently,
right.
So he had to call a cab to go back and pick up the last of his precious documents and the purse and those kinds of things from the house. And they got to the house, and the cab took him to the house and picked up the purse. He and his girlfriend picked up this purse and their personal effects, went back to the place where they had moved to, and they realized they didn't have any cash. And he turned to the cab driver and he said, look, I'm without cash. Can I pay you tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
And the cab driver said, yes, you may, just pay it to the office when you come. And he noticed that when he left the cab, this gentleman, that it was cab 21. Well, these two people that reported on our Bell show went back to the cab headquarters,
mm-hmm.
or the dispatching office, and said that the driver of cab 21 helped us last night, and my girlfriend left her purse in his cab. But we'd like to pay him, and we'd like to retrieve the purse. And the man looked in shock, and he said, you can't do that. And he said, why not? He says, go in the back. And they went in the back, and there was this cab 21 all mangled and crunched up. And apparently it had been in an accident 6 months ago and killed the driver.
Oh, my.
But they went, and they found this lady's purse inside that cab.
In the crunched cab?
In the crunched cab. Now, that was on our bill. But now listen to the rest of the story. The rest of the story is that night, my daughter was suffering. She had been divorced, and her husband was a violent person. We won't talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But she went to a party, and her husband, her ex-husband, showed up at the party and started creating an entire problem, so she called a cab. And a cab showed up. She got out, got into the cab, and she said to the cab driver, I don't have any money, but can you take me home? He said, no problem. He said, but you really don't want to go home because your husband, your ex-husband, might find you there and harm you.
Mm.
He said, what you need to do is drive around with me for several hours tonight. Let's go pick up some fares, and I will protect you. So she drove around with this cab driver all night. She said, the funny thing was is that he never took a fare from a single human being that whole night. And she said, Dad, I got out of the cab, and he said, you can pay me later. Call the office. She looked back, and the cab number...
21. That's a great story.
She called back to the cab company, and they did not have a cab 21.
That's a great story.
That's a true story. My daughter told I shiver to this day when I think of that.
There's an angel out there in cab 21 somewhere.
And if this was a person, she physically rode with him. She shook his hand. He never collected a fare from her, nor from anyone during the evening. And I'll never forget Art Bell for that. I'll never forget him as long as I live. I mean, I'm so grateful for the antecedent of that story. It just makes it all the more interesting to me.
It does. The tie-in is something else.
It's incredible. And, you know, we're not the only people that have had these experiences. How many people have been rescued on the side of the road? You know, I remember being with I had a friend who had been recently separated from her husband. She worked in the same restaurant I did. And she sat me down. She was sobbing. She says, I don't know what to do. I just don't know what to do. I am totally upset that my husband and I have separated. He just plain doesn't understand me. And I turned to her, and this was the time when I was writing my book, Hidden Stories of the Childhood of Jesus. I said, you know, God protects us all. Why don't you pray about it? Well, here's the rest of the story. Her husband got home. He was a truck driver. Got home 3 days later. He was coming down from Idaho into the state of Utah on that back road where there's 60 miles of nothing.
Yeah, straight.
Straight from Twin Falls into Salt Lake City. There's not even a gas station. There's not even lights of farmhouses, okay? He said he pulled over the side of the road. There was a guy hitchhiking in this remote region. He gets into his truck, and immediately he shook his hand. Immediately, this person starts talking to him about his wife and trying to reason with him about how he should understand his wife and how important that is to him. And then all of a sudden, before they got to the lights of Tremont in Utah there, he said, this is my stop. He says, there's nothing out here. He says, no, this is my stop. And so he let him out, but it was cold. It was an inch of snow on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
He let him out there. He figured he was going to hike to a farmhouse. But he got about 100 yards down the road, and he was so moved by what the man said and so concerned about his health, he went back, and the man was gone.
Poof.
And he went back, and he told his wife that story, and they got back together.
And they're everywhere. These kinds
of... Now, how many times have we heard these stories, George?
I know it. And I'm looking forward to the next hour, too, because we'll open up the phone lines and see if we can get some more, Glenn.
Without any doubt.
It happened. What do you think it is? I mean, what do you think it is?
Well, I really believe that the undead are commissioned to intervene in the lives of men and perform rescues. And people will ask me...
Why do you call them the undead? It sounds kind of vampire-ish.
It is a morbid... I call them the undead in order to be specific.
Okay.
We lump them into angels, then we lump them into a completely huge category, which is not specific. That includes guardian angels, which are disembodied spirits, which are not tangible. We're lumping them into angels that come from the presence of God, archangels, etc., which are the same disembodied spirit. The undead, though, are the tangible. You know, Sylvia Brown says that the angels have the power to pick up a body and intervene in the lives of men. I respect Sylvia Brown for what she says, but in this particular case, I think she needs to take the next step, which is to suggest that the people who are the corporal versions of these angels aren't angels at all in the classical sense of angels, but are really people who have not yet died, who have been commissioned to intervene in the lives of men.
Because of their physical involvement with humans?
Exactly.
Okay.
Because they have the power to physically intervene. And by the way, they walk in amongst people unseen and undetected. They're perfectly camouflage.
Well, see, that explains this then. Another caller to me said that he was out in the ocean swimming, okay, which I would never do because I'm afraid I wouldn't be able to swim back. But that's what he was doing. And he said, you know what, I was going down. A current got me. And he said, I was going down, and I couldn't get back up. And this was it. He said, I was just ready. I was going to meet my maker, and it was all done for me. But he said, out of the blue, and he could still see the blue sky as he's going down, because it was pretty clear water. He says, I see a hand reach in and go underwater where it reaches me. Now, he doesn't think that he's already 10 or 15 feet underwater,
oh my God,
but he sees a hand reach down and get him, which has got to be in a 15-foot arm. I don't know how you do that.
Oh,
and
God,
he grabs the hand, Glenn, and he says the hand pulls him up. He grasps his hand, and then he's breathing for air when he's on the surface and realizes there's nobody around. He's in an ocean, maybe 100 yards offshore. There's nobody there. And he's saying, my God, did this other person start to drown? And he panicked for a little bit, and he went underwater to look for this other person. He couldn't find anybody. He made it back to shore. People who were witnessing what had happened said, and this is the chilling part of it, they said, we saw you go under, and we thought, oh, my God, he's gone. But when we saw you come up, you had your arm sticking out of the water as if you were being pulled by someone.
Oh, my God.
Now, isn't that something?
Oh, my gosh.
But you do see a distinctively difference between guardian angels, and what you call the undead as well, right?
Definitely. There are at least three different classifications of beings. There's the Elohim, or the deity, which is one, which is plural, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
In Genesis, it said, let us make man in our own image. They include all the us and the our, you know. There are the resurrected beings, which are people who, in Matthew 27:52-53, there were more than one person resurrected at the time of Christ, obviously. In fact, Tiberius Caesar had to seal the tombs of Rome to keep the dead from rising in Rome at that very time. And in fact, that was a worldwide phenomenon. We can read about that through history books all across the globe. We could get into that another time in discussion of Halloween, which was the celebration of All Saints Day, or the rising of the saints from the dead.
All right.
Yeah. But the beings we're talking about are not the angels either, because the angels are disembodied spirits. Once again, if you were to shake their hand, you would not feel them. These are people that are intervening in our life because they have been in our life.
Like the ocean story that I mentioned right before the break.
That was
one of those, right?
Exactly. And my little brother had an experience where he was out cross-country skiing in the back hills of Colorado, and he had gotten lost. Now, if you get lost cross-country skiing, it's a very serious matter. You can die.
You freeze to death, and nobody finds you for a long time.
That's true. And the snow allows you to be able to see in all directions for some distance,
mm-hmm,
against the white background. Well, he got lost, and he had completely broken down in terms of his attitude. He figured he was a cooked goose because the sun was going down, when a person skied up to him and said, do you have a problem? And he shook his hand and said, yeah, I do. I don't know where I'm at. He said, follow my trail, and you'll find your way back to the city. And my brother followed his trail. He got along the trail for just a short piece. He looked back to see if the gentleman was still there, and he was missing. He was gone.
Poof, he was gone, too.
He no longer was in the tracks.
Where do they go? Why don't they hang around for the glory of the thanks?
We need to ask the Lone Ranger the same reason. I don't, I'm not trying to be irreverent, but I often wonder, why don't they hang around? I don't think their purpose is to receive glory. You know, Jesus often spoke when he performed all of his healings. What was the very first thing he did after the people were healed? He told the people to go and tell no one.
Mm-hmm. He didn't want the accolades for that.
The accolades were an interference in the process.
Yes.
Not an aid to the process. These people, in order to provide a perfect camouflage for their intervention, have to disappear. And there are many people who try to rush to conclusions. They shake their head and said, did that really happen to me? It must have been, you know. They rush to a conclusion, try and find a scenario that makes sense, and many people come up with a justification or manufacture a reason or a rationale, when in reality, there is no rationale.
Who assigns them, Glenn, to come down and save the human being?
Frankly, I don't know. It would be, I'm sure that it has to do with the protocol in the heavens. People ask me from time to time, well, if these people can actually perform rescues, why don't they just solve all problems? And I tell them, I say, well, the reason we came to Earth to begin with was to experience fully good and evil. If you eradicated evil from the world, it would eliminate at the same time all the purpose and reason for this short period of time.
Do you think the helper has any relationship with the person he has saved? Like the hand that came through and pulled the guy out of the ocean, maybe it might have been a deceased relative or something like that.
I think in this particular case, not. Because of the references that these people who do not have parents, do not have children, are not referenced to friends or associates, they tend to not have genealogy that is relevant in this case. That's my initial impression. But once again, I'm not the one that writes the protocol in the heavens, but that's what it appears to me, that they have no relationship. Now, on the other hand, there are times when there are other relatives that do appear, but I don't hear stories where these relatives actually physically intervene in the lives of these people. The ones where there's a physical intervention are someone else.
Do you find that you get more types of intervention during periods of, like Christmas and times where people, of course, should be good to people all the time, but during these kinds of periods? Or does that matter?
I don't know. You're asking me a question. I really don't know, George. I know that they appear more often in times of crisis. In times of war, during the Second World War, there was a barrage of these kinds of events.
Right.
Conflict, I'm sure, I don't even want to go there, but there were some stories about 911. We don't want to go there at all, out of reverence to the event.
Yes, I understand.
But at a time of crisis, these things tend to occur. I noticed that there was a story in between on the border of Utah and Arizona, right out here near Arizona where I live,
mm-hmm.
where there was a bus. There was a gentleman driving through the Dixie Forest, which, by the way, is a wonderful drive. And he came across a little child, appeared to him a little child, who was on the side of the road hitchhiking. Being a little child, he stopped and he said, "What are you doing up here in the forest, for goodness sake?" He said, "Well, can you give me a ride?" And got into the car. And the little boy, without saying a word, pointed off to the right about a mile or two down the road, and he saw these two tracks headed off the edge of a cliff. And the man stopped the car because they looked fresh. He looked down there, and there was a bus.
Oh my!
Down there that had been freshly wrecked. And all through the Dixie Forest, he tried to use his cell phone, and it wouldn't work because there was no coverage.
Right.
But suddenly, his cell phone worked, and he dials 911, you know? And he gets police, and within a few minutes, you know, with 10 or 15 minutes, he got a rescue crew from the city of Escalante, and they came out, and they started getting these children out of this bus, but there was about 7 or 8 dead children in the back.
Oh.
And the very last little child that they brought out of the bus happened to be this little kid. And he turned around and the child was gone. Now, that's a story that's been famous on the news.
What a wonderful story.
What a wonderful story. And yet, you know, I don't know. I don't understand them, George. I really don't. I know that I had my experience. I couldn't even tell you who I met. I could tell you what he looked like. And I've interviewed over 1,000 people who have had similar experiences. And by the way, several of them told me that the person I described looked like the one that they had met.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I tell people that the person that I met wore a ball cap. That's what I saw.
What team, by the way?
The Atlanta Braves, actually. And the story that I most recently got from a gentleman was that the person who had intervened in his life had a ball cap with the Atlanta Braves on it.
Now, that's incredible.
Now, I don't understand that.
Was he an older person?
He was about 30. He looked about in his mid-30s.
Not old at all.
Not a real old man. But the thing that's amazing to me, George, is that I'm colorblind. And I mean acutely colorblind.
I didn't know that.
And I saw blue in this man's eyes that I had never seen before.
Almost like the sky?
Oh, very much so. I don't know. I can't tell you what the sky looks like, so I can't tell you. But that's what I imagine the sky would look like.
You've been colorblind since birth?
Yes. Yes, I have been.
What does the sky look like to you? I'm curious now.
Well, how can a colorblind person tell you what the sky is?
Do you have a concept of color at all?
Sure I do. I have a concept in my head, but it probably doesn't match the real world.
You'll never be able to tell me that. That's true.
We can't communicate on this issue because I don't know. I know what this color was in this man's eyes, and it matched my concept of what blue is. And it's something that I had never seen before. And it was almost frightening. In the same way it was frightening for George Washington when he saw it, when he had his experience.
What happened to him?
Well, George Washington in Valley Forge had an experience on December 18, 1777. He had been studying at his table for 3 hours, so he wasn't asleep. And he looked up, and there was a being standing in front of him at his table. It scared him a little bit. It caused him to be more awake. I mean, it frightened him a little bit. And he said to the being, he said, "Can I help you?" And got no response. He asked the question 4 times and got no response. And then suddenly, the being said, "Son of the Republic, look and learn." And then came everything broke loose. The walls of the tent disappeared, and he saw the vision of 3 different major conflicts that were going to come into America's history. And the being that was in front of him, who appeared like you and me, it wasn't surrounded by light. He obviously could touch this being's hand, but this being was just like you and I. But this being sent him on this vision of another being that stood over the ocean and dipped his hand in the water,
mm-hmm.
and showed him the continents that would be in conflict with the Americas, not to exclude that of the Middle East. And when he came out of his tent, his 2 old friends, Anthony Sherman and David Perry, who had fought alongside him at the French and Indian War and were with him at Valley Forge, sat down and both of them recorded separately this vision, or they called it a vision, but it was really more of an encounter. They wrote it down word for word. And the one last thing that George Washington said and is recorded in the reflection of an old soldier by David Perry was that George Washington said, "I saw that we should fear September 11th.
And he had no idea.
This was published before 1830 as in the Library of Congress. I didn't invent this. This is not something I invented. This has been in print since the beginning of our country.
Yeah, that book was called Reflections of an Old Soldier, wasn't it?
By David Perry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly out of print at this point, but it's something that can be looked up and verified on the net.
It's there.
I didn't invent it. This is something that's there.
Right.
But I put together a CD of all of the visions and the prayers of George Washington. There were some very strange things that happened to George Washington, though he appeared in, there were many historians who felt like he wasn't even religious. But I go through all of that and describe the difference between his public persona, which had to be very neutral, because he had to amass an army together who were a very different face. And in those days, people were drawn along political lines and along religious lines very severely. And so he had to remain neutral in this environment so that he did not ostracize and create conflict within his own already tenuous army. So he was very, very neutral, but he did share with his best friends many of these amazing experiences, which were prophecies of the future, and depicted his own personal beliefs, when in reality, in public, he appeared as a very neutral. He never mentioned the word God very few times, and certainly never used the word Jesus in his public persona.
Can I guess who that figure was in his tent?
I would like you to guess.
Melchizedek?
Maybe so.
Maybe?
Maybe so.
What were the three conflicts that he saw on... I would guess Civil War was one.
Well, yeah, he saw the Civil War because he saw the rising of... He said Africa had a cloud over it, and that people would be fighting each other in the cities and villages of the towns within the Americas. The only time that's ever happened was at the time of the Civil War, and amazingly, that was associated in his vision with Africa. And the other one was a great conflict, which was a war between the European countries and the United States. And then the last conflict, amazingly, has not yet happened. There's a conflict where there's a light of a thousand suns that hasn't... That conflict hasn't happened yet, and I hate to speculate what that is all about.
How disastrous was that, did he say?
He said at the very end that the being told him, son of the Republic, the Republic will be preserved.
Well, that's a good thing.
Oh, yes, that was the final comment, by the way, in his vision. The Republic will be preserved, and... I go through it detail by detail, as I do in the Melchizedek CD. I take it chapter and verse and do it in detail and tell you the entire story so that people who are interested in this kind of thing can get the rest of the story.
Do you talk about specific dates at all, Glenn?
Yes, the only date that comes out of the vision of George Washington is the September 11th date.
Just that date, not the year, nothing like that.
No year at
all. Just the date, and obviously... 9/11 is a day that, of course, will live in infamy as well.
Without any doubt at all. But, you know, what I'm trying to suggest is that these encounters that come into the lives of men are commonplace, not only amongst the common people, but amongst kings and presidents and rulers, and come at a moment of crisis. Can you imagine a moment of crisis any more poignant than Valley Forge? December 18th. My goodness.
I wonder how many kings and presidents and prime ministers react to policy based on visitations or prophetic information that they might get.
Oh, only heaven knows. Only heaven knows.
Oh, that's an understatement too, Glenn.
Oh, yeah. I can assure you one thing, that there are things we are not told. For good reason. I am sure that the agenda of George Washington when he came out of Valley Forge was, and he made it perfectly clear, because he hired people based on the same agenda. He said, we must be accepting of the Jew, the Gentile, the Islam, and specifically the atheist, together as a brotherhood. He said it clearly in his own words.
Welcome back. I'm George Norrie, Glenn Kimball, my guest, and your phone calls. So the prophecy of George Washington, he doesn't have the date, though, for that big battle, does he?
No, he doesn't. And, you know, one thing I wanted to add before we get too far, there's some suggestion, question over gender of this being that visited him. The accounts vary between Anthony Sherman and David Perry. Even within the context of the Anthony Sherman text itself, it said that a woman appeared, or he also uses the pronoun he. So I often think that maybe this being was the antecedent of Our Lady Liberty that's on the back of our silver dollar, that maybe she was the voice of prophecy from the time of George Washington. But it opens up the idea that maybe the undead would include feminine entities as well as masculine entities. So I, you know, in my tape, I treat it neutrally in that respect and allow people to make up their own mind. I give the text entirely detail for detail. So, but the gender does, for some reason, the gender does mold itself back and forth between the two accounts. I wanted to make sure that that was clear as well.
All right, let's go to some of the phones. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with Glenn Kimball. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello, I'm Joe, first-time caller from Denver. And I have a couple stories, angelic stories, I guess, I'd like to share.
Yeah, sure thing. What happened?
About 6-7 years ago, I was arrived home, and it was starting to rain, and I cut through the lawn to run up to my apartment. And I slipped right before I got to the stairs. There were railroad ties coming down the stairs. And as I slipped, I went up into the air, and I started thinking to myself, well, you know, I'm going to hit the ground pretty hard. You know, I was already preparing myself for a hard hit.
Trying to brace yourself.
Yes, exactly. And I get up. In fact, my feet probably went up above my head. You know, I was pretty horizontal to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And just as I was thinking, bracing myself for the fall, I got this feeling like, sort of like when you watch in The Matrix, how things just kind of go on hold.
Really slow really motion. Slow. Yeah.
Exactly. And everything around me just kind of slowed down. And it was like somebody or something was holding me and kind of just gently put me down until I got about maybe a foot off the ground. And then I just fell to the ground.
Almost. Could you feel the pressure of somebody holding you?
Sort of. It's hard to explain.
No, you're doing all right. Go ahead.
Like I said, it was sort of like what you see in The Matrix, you know, when they're going through their fight scenes and everything slows down, and I felt that way.
Well, what do you think something like that is, Glenn? Is that the angelic, or is that the undead person that is taking care of him?
In this specific case, you know, I obviously am a third party and don't know, but certainly those kind of events where something very strange happens, I tend to believe that it's the undead that intervene. The angels are usually messengers, not interveners in the lives of men. So I would preclude in my mind that somehow the undead had a piece of that particular story.
Well, you might be right there. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with Glenn Kimball. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
I have a question.
He's there. Go ahead.
And I've called before, and this just seems like an opportune time because Glenn sounds like he might be able to help me. And I appreciate you taking my phone call.
No problem.
I've been a union organizer for about 10 years. Five or six years ago, I was really questioning whether or not what I was doing was right. I work with a lot of people in Georgia here that are Baptists, and they said, well, you know, based on revelations, you shouldn't be doing this, and so on. So I was questioning my, you know, based on my religious values. One night while sleeping, I had a very vivid dream. I didn't see anything, but I heard a voice very clearly speaking to me. Like we were having a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
The voice was telling me that, you know, follow your heart. You know, you're doing what God wants you to do. At that instant, I woke up, and there was, I think it was an angel that was standing next to my bed. And it startled me, and I shook, and my wife woke up. She saw it, and just in a flash after that, it vanished. But I was wondering if you might be able to help me identify it possibly. And
well, the interesting thing about your tale is that there were two people that were witnessing the same event. That's not an aberration of the mind. This is not a flashback from your LSD days at Haight-Ashbury.
Oh, no.
Because if you share the same experience, it is a corroborative event. I really believe that most of us seem to allow other agendas to dictate what we should or should not believe, when in reality, it has often been, in fact, it's always been my comment, that the greatest work that a man will ever do is within the confines of his own flesh, and that it is your responsibility to do what you're supposed to do, and you have every right to have information based on your own protocol in life as anybody else has had. And so I really encourage you in what you're doing that to not allow... My father told me when I was 8 years old that third parties are always negative. Those third parties can be political institutions, parents, children, friends, loved ones, churches, anybody. When in reality, the third party is never an integral part of the events and the passion of what you're doing in your life. We need to follow the direction that it comes from within. That's what a conscience is all about. A conscience is the voice of deity in your life. I know that it certainly is not something that's biological or natural selected in evolution. A conscience to do what is morally right is something that is beyond that of natural selection in origin. So,
I've actually had, since that time, I've had two other experiences, and I didn't see anything, but I took my oldest son and I went for a weekend trip to Savannah. And I had something happen. We were napping in the hotel room, and I I felt the bed shake, and I woke up, and it was still shaking for a few seconds, and I felt like a cold go through me, not like a, you know, not like a draft.
I felt a presence
in the room.
Well, that certainly is something that happened to me first time when I was 8 years old. I actually saw somebody when I was 8 years old, and it was totally frightening for an eight-year-old kid to do that. But the thing that I find most impressive about your story is that there's millions of people who have had these experiences that they've shared simultaneously with someone else. I've had that experience where there was a malevolent force in my home that opened my kitchen doors, my cupboard doors, and threw the dishes against the wall. And there were other people present mm-hmm. at the time.
So I was going to ask you, Glenn, for every great, heartwarming, good story that's out there, is there also that evil story that counterbalances it with somebody else, good and evil, just going hand in hand?
I think once you open the door to the unseen world, that door is fair game for both sides. To the extent that you open it for one side, it opens up for the other, and that's why you have to be very careful in this arena. When you open it up, that there'll be some in the religious community who will tell you that the only experiences you have are all evil. That's ridiculous. Or that all the experiences you have are all good, and that is equally ridiculous. It is your judgment and your conscience and your internal feeling of what is right and wrong. I think people sense instantly, as George Washington did in his tent that day, what was good and what was not good.
You know, there's no doubt about that.
And there's no question in your mind what team you're playing on. You know, the colors are a sensation that you cannot get rid of.
If you want to play for evil, you know what you're doing.
Exactly.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there. You're on with us.
How you doing?
Good.
Glenn, how you doing?
Excellent.
I got a really cool story that happened to me. I do agree with you what you said about the good and the evil. I am religious myself, but I won't go into the bad part of the story, but I'll tell you the good one.
Okay. And where are you calling from, by the way?
Bakersfield.
Okay. California.
Well, I was probably about 20-some-odd years old, and... some time back, and I had stopped by my mom and my sister's house, and they asked me to go up to Taco Bell. Nothing against Taco Bell, I love them, but go up. I said sure, I'll run over there and get a few burritos, some tacos, whatnot, and go over there, get my order. And like I said, nothing against these guys. I pulled over just to make sure everything was in the bag, and I had my windows up, and I'm looking over there in the bag, checking stuff out. And I hear this like light tap on my window. And I turn around, and there's this guy. And I know that he's every bit of well into his 70s. You know, I mean, you could tell because he had those, like, white rings around his eyes. You could just tell he was old, you know, old and sodded, so to speak. But he had these really kind blue eyes.
Uh-oh.
And he didn't know English. You know, he was Hispanic, obviously, a Hispanic gentleman. And I rolled my window down, and he just kind of motions his hand a little bit forward, and I just instinctively knew that he probably needed, you know, some change. And I reached over and grabbed a $1.50 or something like that because, you know, I felt compelled to do that. And when I handed him the change, he didn't say nothing, but he pointed his hand up to the sky, you know, with his index finger. And he just kind of shakes his head, nods it. And I go, yep. He's definitely watching us. So, and, you know, anyway, I said good day and rolled my window up. He just goes his own way. I just do a double glance over into the bag. And you got to understand, there's like a vacant field in front of this parking lot, and there's no other cars by me. It just happened to be no other cars by me. So I glance back in my rearview mirror just because I didn't want to run this guy over. And I look back there, and he's gone. And it really blew me away because I'm like looking around. It's like, how did this old man move? You know what I mean? I'm like blown away. I'm like, this guy can move.
And you're hoping he's not on the bottom of your car, right?
No, I was just tripping because I knew immediately. I was like, wait a minute. And then, like a few weeks later, I just ran across this scripture, and it was in Hebrews. Glenn, you probably read it before, in Hebrews 13, chapter 2, about remembering, hospitality towards strangers, because we, you know, can be entertaining angels unaware. And it really, really had a significant, you know, purpose in my life, you know, because I've ever since then I've been really, really, you know, had a soft spot in my heart for homeless people. And I can remember this guy's face to this day, and it's been like 15 years ago.
I've always heard that there aren't a lot of angels out there that are helping, Glenn, that just a handful are doing all of the work. Do you believe that?
No. I believe there are many.
Millions?
Don't know, George.
I guess you can't even put a number to it.
No, but the experience of this young man is you know how many times I've heard this tapping on the window story,
and the
old man who asked for a little bit of change, and then something totally bizarre happened?
Yes.
How many times I've heard this same story? I've heard it a dozen times. Your experience is very common. You share that with some wonderful people whose lives have been changed by that experience. You must understand that the heavens give no credence to money. Money tends to focus our attention because it's money. But to the heavens, it means nothing.
Well, you know, I wish to us it could mean nothing. I really do.
Yes, and sometimes our experiences are punctuated by giving the widow's mite to people. But in reality, they are accompanied by this totally a strange experience which focuses our attention. I've heard this story, I can't tell you, I've heard it at least a dozen times, of the tapping on the window. I even heard one time where a person tapped on the window. In fact, it was from a major radio host. He said he tapped on the window, and the person asked for some money, and he gave him $20, and the gentleman went back to the restaurant up the street, and there was a picture of the same man who had tapped on the window over the hearth, over the main bar there at the restaurant, and this being had died some 20 years prior. And so this experience of the tapping on the window thing is a totally familiar experience to me. You're in the company of great men. I congratulate you.
Let's go to our first time caller line. Welcome to Coast. You're on with Glenn Kimball. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just was going to share an experience. I came from a bad background. My mother went through exorcisms and stuff when I was a little kid, so I was always afraid of religion.
Mm-hmm.
I married a woman that is fairly religious, but I never went to church or anything. I did drugs and alcohol. And about 7 years ago, I was going through my radio. I'm a truck driver, and all I could get was a Christian station. And previously to that, I had a dream the night before, and then I picked a guy up. I was tired, and I just wanted somebody to talk to. And I picked this guy up, and he described my dream to me and kind of explained it to me. Well, I thought I was asleep, you know, because I was tired, like I said, and I was driving down the road, and all of a sudden I felt something grab the wheel and say, look out, because I went in, well, obviously I went to sleep, but I drifted off the shoulder, and I just in time before I hit a car that was on the shoulder there, I looked on the side of me, and there was nobody there.
But you felt that pulling, huh?
Yeah.
Wow, you know, and once again, this is a familiar experience, by the way.
I've heard a couple of those like that, where a hand pulls the wheel to the right, for example, when they were drifting to the left. They would have gone head-on, let's say, with a truck or something like that.
Exactly, and the part that I found familiar was something that happens in my own life. My radio decides what it wants to play when it wants to play it. I've changed the radio out, and it doesn't make any difference. It has its own mind of its own. When I'm supposed to be listening to a station, it changes the station for me.
Let's hope it changes it to coast to coast.
It does.
Here's a story that is just in, by the way. Actor John Ritter, who has gained fame playing the lovable characters in a pair of television comedies decades apart now, has apparently died. Details of the circumstances of his death not immediately known. Ritter, best known for his portrayal of Jack in the 1970s situation comedy Three's Company, and recently he starred in the series Eight Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, a centerpiece of broadcaster ABC's upcoming fall schedule. John Ritter was the son of country singer and actor Tex Ritter. I believe he was about 55 years old or so. Sitcom star John Ritter dead tonight. No other details immediately available. Boy, Glenn, that's an unbelievable story. You know what?
It is indeed.
I have enjoyed his work tremendously.
I met him one time, and he was a absolutely wonderful person.
Oh, yeah. Guys, I used to remember him on Three's Company. I used to laugh my head off with some of the things that he used to do.
Totally tolerant.
There's another soul out there, huh?
Indeed and true.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. You ready?
Ready.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is Mike from Largo, Florida.
Hi, Mike.
Glenn, you were speaking earlier about the undead and how they change and influence living?
Yes.
Well, I got a really unbelievable story that I was, this is about 7 years ago, I was with my friend in a car and it was raining and we got into a car accident and they tried to revive him five times. I rode along with him in the ambulance, went to the hospital, and he was down for about 45 minutes, and they declared him dead. Well, the weird thing was that I was waiting in the waiting room, and somebody just sat by me, and then doctors came to me and told me he's dead, and I told the doctors, no, he's not. And then, like, another 10 minutes passes, and he comes, my friend comes walking out with the sheets from the gurney and tells us, go outside. And doctors start looking around for him. Finally, they come outside, and they can't explain it. And so I told the doctors, I told you, he wasn't dead.
Well, that person that sits next to you, this is a very common story, too, and I don't mean to minimize this magnificent tale.
It's a wonderful story.
It is a common story in the sense that many of us have had someone sit next to us and advise us, tell us to do something, and that person, we look over and they're not there. I had one time in my car when I was driving down the road, It was 11:30 at night, and the person sitting next to me said, "Stop your car." And I looked over, and obviously the person who said that was not there. I got out, I kicked the tires, I looked around, I thought, oh my goodness, something's wrong with my car. And I had a whole bunch of keys. My father was a real estate magnate, and so he had keys to a lot of different properties.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I happened to be parked across the street from one of his buildings that he'd owned, and I decided that I would go in. I unlocked the door, sat down on this couch in this warehouse-type building, and I said, you know, Lord, if you want me to be here, I'll just wait. So I crossed my arms and just sat there and waited. 2 minutes later, I looked and I see the closet across the foyer from me. I could see the doorknob turning. Now, this was macabre. You know, I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, you know. And out through that door ran a burglar with a mask on. And so I chased him out the back of the building, and there was a semi-truck with all of the office furniture from the up and down the strip mall there. And safes and all kinds of things in this thing. So I called the police. They come out, they chase, they got the guy, you know. And my father, I called my father on the phone. He comes running up there with a baseball bat. I thought he was going to kill me. And he said, what in the world were you doing inside my building at this time of night? And I said, Dad, I can't tell you because then you will hit me with a baseball bat.
Yeah, exactly. Then you really want me.
Yeah.
I love it. Let's go back to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yes, I was wondering if the Maitreya may be related to the subject you're talking about tonight.
The Maitreya, you've heard of him, Glenn. Some are calling him the Antichrist, and he's already here. I don't think that has anything to do with what you're saying tonight.
I don't see a connection. I don't see him as being one of the undead at all, or being related to the undead experience. But interesting question, but I don't see a connection.
All right, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with Glenn Kimball. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
My name's Ben. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thanks.
I've had experiences when I've been out driving my car since I've got my license. I usually take just a set route. You know, when I go someplace, I take the same route there, same route back. And I've had experiences where I felt like a spirit or someone telling me or an urge that to go a different route, instead of like getting on the freeway, taking a side road. And almost all the times that I've done that, I have come across someone who needed help, like their car broke down, or like an old lady needed to change a tire, or somebody's car was broken down, they needed a ride or a phone. And I've always kind of felt, it's kind of funny how, you know, I've had those feelings of having to do that, and there's usually always someone there that like needed my help, or I've gone that way and something's happened to me and people have come and helped me.
By the way, I want to compliment you on one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus said it in his words. He said, "Those we must have ears to hear and eyes to see." You must be one of those individuals who has ears to hear and is willing to listen. By the way, I have had that experience. I won't get into it because I've told too many of my own as well. But I congratulate you on being willing to be a part of, I call it a guest at the party. Pardon me, I coined vernacular probably irreverently, but when you get to be a guest in the rescue of other people, it is the sweetest experience in life. And you, my friend, are a character that has become a fraternal member and a guest at this party. You must be a wonderful person.
Oh, that's a nice compliment for him. Very, very nice indeed. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is Juanita, and I'm calling from Missouri.
Sure.
And I wanted to tell you about my sister that lives in Collinsville. She had a son that passed away, and he lived in Cahokia. So my younger sister and I were going up to the funeral, and my husband was a truck driver, so he knew all over everywhere. And so he just told me not to go to East St. Louis. And so I said, okay. Well, then we got there too early, and we were looking for a place to have a little bite of lunch. And somehow or another, we on the bridge, and it took us straight to East St. Louis.
Uh-oh.
And so we were going around up and down the street. We didn't want to get too far away from the way we got over there, but we could not find a road to get back on. My sister went up to a school to knock on the windows. They had bars on the doors and windows, and people was in there. They had the lights, and we could see them, but they would not come to the door. And so I told her just to get back in the car. And so I said, we'll find the way. And I was praying and praying, and my mother was deceased. And I said, Mom, I said, we cannot find our way. And I said, I'm getting really scared. I said, please help us find the way to get over there. And all of a sudden, I said to my sister, I said, Sharon, there's a road. And she said, well, it wasn't there a while ago. And I said, well, it's here now. Let's take it. So it was just like that we were going smoothly through the air. And I looked back, and there was nothing behind me. And so then I saw a sign that said Cahokia. And then whenever we got in line with the traffic, I said, Sharon, look back. There is no road.
Oh.
And our hands, you know, we grabbed each other's hands, and they were just like ice.
Wow.
I mean, that is the honest to God truth.
Now, that's a first for you, Glenn, huh?
Well, I've been lost in East St. Louis in the middle of the night, and I know that experience.
Oh, yeah.
I'm on my way to get to Southern Illinois. I got lost on that same freeway. But I did not have that experience. What a wonderful tale.
They built a road.
Tell you one more thing, if I may.
I don't have time, hon. I've got so many other callers, but thank you for that one. I do appreciate it. Let's go to our wild card line. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George.
Yes.
I have a comment to Glenn.
Okay, he's listening.
He made a reference to an Atlanta Brave hat. Is that correct?
Yes.
What is the letter on the hat?
What was the letter on the hat? I have no idea.
A.
An A? Did you say an A?
A.
Yes.
I think that he was telling you he was an angel.
I have never thought of that.
Yeah.
My goodness.
I've been working with an angel reader for the
past. He should have come in with the angel's hat. That's what he should have done, huh?
Oh, either one had an A on it.
Interesting.
Oh, one more thing.
Yeah.
I've been working with an angel reader, and it's starting to wear off.
What's an angel reader?
She will tell you who your guide is, and she tunes into the angels that are around you and tells you what's going on in that manner, which is different than a medium.
What gives her that, I don't want to use the word power, but what gives her that ability?
Well, she studied under Doreen Virtue, and she just has gained the power, and she has told me some things that nobody else could have possibly known.
I know Doreen well, but... Yeah, the angel should have had the angel's hat. That would have done it that way, Glenn.
I don't know. It was a Braves hat. I can't explain it. Maybe Ted Turner could. I don't know.
Let's go to West of the Rockies. You've got a sense of humor, too. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going, George?
We are doing well.
Glenn,
thanks.
Hey, I got a little story, a little angel story. It's kind of cheesy, but it ties into a question I got.
Sure.
I was taking this really hard operating system class, and I was freaking out the day before finals, right? And my mom was all, just pray, and the angels will help you, right? And I'm kind of like, you know, I'm not a very religious person. And so, you know, I end up in the class early because I'd always show up early. We were one of the first ones in the classroom, me and my buddy. And we were just, you know, walking around the room, pacing back and forth and, you know, talking to each other. And it had been vacuumed. They had been vacuumed the day before. And sitting, the only thing in the classroom that didn't belong there, on the pedestal in the middle of the classroom where the teacher would instruct, was a little cheesy little angel pin. And I was all, oh, my God. And I did fine on it. But I have a question. In that class, we learned about demons. And apparently demons means divinity. And you said that Homer had used the, he had integrated the Mikhelsnik knowledge into the Greek mythology. And in the Greek mythology, the humans would use, they would get a demon to talk to the gods, like a kind of like a liaison.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if there was any kind of correlation, or what is the correlation here between a demon and Homer's and the Mikhelsnikness of it all?
Well, you ask an interesting question. I have an answer for that, but I'm not sure it would be satisfactory to everybody. It might offend people. I think that those practices which evoke an intermediary between ourself and the heavens are the demonic practices. The ones that are not demonic practices are the ones where you do your own praying for yourself. That's interesting that the demon is, in fact, often called in that same fashion you describe. And, you know, the demonic angels were, in fact, the fallen ones were exactly like ourselves, sons and daughters of God in that great council before the world was held. And there is some reason to liken them unto ourselves, at least in the inception of things. The only thing that they did wrong was that they chose to confront deity and his purposes. And trust me, he's a big boy and can defend himself. And you don't cross the Elohim. You do exactly as they do, or you don't play in the ball game. So interesting you'd say that. You know, that's I really believe that one of the protocols that has integrated itself into our society is that for some reason we've allowed the intermediaries come into our lives to do our praying for us. And in the Old Testament, it calls them familiar spirits. King Saul was told the world that we should avoid familiar spirits and do our own praying for ourselves, though he himself fell victim to that and consulted a medium at the final battle before he lost his own life. And she told him he would die the next day, which he did die in battle the next day. So he violated his own protocol. But my comment is that intermediaries trying to do your praying for you is probably a real bad idea. You ought to do it for yourself.
You got to do it for yourself. I'm amazed at the word lived. You spell it backwards. It's devil.
Whoa.
Isn't that weird?
We're going to get you on MTV here.
Glenda, the clock is ticking. We might have time for one more real quick call. Let's go to our wild card line. Hi there, you're on Coast to Coast.
Hi, this is Wayne from Wichita.
Go ahead, Wayne.
I had a sort of a story and a question for Glenn.
I'll only have time for the question, okay? Go ahead.
Okay. I've sort of had visions, and one of them was a week before my grandfather died. I had a vision, and I knew it was going to happen. It was exactly a week. Is this sort of thing sort of like a angelic intervention, or could it be sort of the undead just not seeing it? I did kind of feel like a presence. I didn't actually see anything, but would that correlate to what he's talking about?
The ancient texts say your young men will see visions, your old men will dream dreams. Come and visit me on my website. You'll hear more about that. There are books on it. And you can get these two CDs at the toll-free number 24 hours a day.
Why don't you give that number out again, Glenn?
888-904-9394. Chapter and verse on these CDs, you'll love it.
Okay, is that 904-9394 or 95?
No, 95,
excuse
me.
That's right, okay. I'm glad I have it written down here.
No, I apologize. I must not be alive.
That's all right. Well, we'll give it out one more time. Just make sure nobody wrote it down the wrong way. 1-888-904-9395.
That's it.
Website already linked up with coasttocoastam.com. And, hey, I got to tell you, if somewhere along the line we walk around and see Malika's, what's his last
Melchizedek.
Name? Melchizedek. See him out there. It'll be for good, and that's the important thing.
You are a delight, George, as always.
Good time. Glenn, take care of yourself, all right?
Bye now.
All right. And again, that number, if you don't have a computer, it's 1-888-904-9395. Melchizedek. I'm glad they didn't give me that name when I was born. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Barbara Simpson, and always Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM.